The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, and always available via podcast. We're on iTunes, Writers on Writing. We're on Stitcher and other podcast platforms. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do each and every week, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft, how they're working and focusing and thinking during these pandemic days. The latter part of that statement is taking center stage today as we're doing something a little special. When the pandemic hit, Jennifer Haupt began thinking of what she could do and how she could contribute to get through it. From that, the project Alone Together, Love, Grief, and Comfort During the Time of COVID-19 was born. It's a collection of 76 best-selling and up-and-coming authors contributing essays, interviews, and poetry about their pandemic experiences. All the authors donated their time and talents to give back to independent bookstores through Book Industry Charitable Foundation, BINC. We will hopefully get a chance to talk about all of that. Today, I'm joined by Jennifer, the editor and contributor to the collection, and three authors and poets whose work appears therein. Many of the authors in this collection, including Jennifer, have been past guests on our show, so a lot of these names will sound familiar to you if you're a regular listener. Jennifer's essays and articles have been published in a lot of places. Oh, the Oprah magazine, Parenting, The Rumpus. She curates a popular Psychology Today blog called One True Thing, a collection of essays and interviews for authors and readers. Her debut novel, In the Shadow of 10,000 Hills, was awarded the Forward Review's Bronze Indie Award for Historical Fiction. She was on the show with me in 2018 for that book. And her second novel, Come As You Are, will be published in 2021. Contributing poet Amber Flame is a poet, writer, composer, and performer whose work has garnered artistic merit residencies with Hedgebrook, Vermont Studio Center, and more. Flame served as the 2017-2019 Poetry Writer in Residence at Hugo House in Seattle. Contributing writer Roberto Lovato is a journalist and author of Unforgetting, a memoir of family, migration, gangs, and revolution in the Americas. And finally, contributing writer Robin Black is the author most recently of the novel Life Drawing and the collection Crash Course, Essays from Where Writing and Life Collide. She's at work on her second novel. She teaches at the Rutgers Camden MFA program. I also want to mention before we dive in that this show is pre-recorded on Monday, August 3rd. It's not airing until closer to the book's release date at the end of August or September. So given how every day is like a month in COVID time, who knows where we'll all find ourselves in September. So if things sound dated somehow when you're hearing this, know that we're talking in early August. Okay, let's dive in. Welcome to all of you. So Jennifer, you're going to do a far better job than I just did in talking about sort of the birth of what you've called your lovely monster. So I'm going to let you do that. I'd love for you to just set the stage for how Alone Together was born.
Once I figured out that we weren't actually going to, by some miracle, be unquarantined in, you know, within a few weeks, it was early April and my book deal had been canceled because my publisher couldn't afford to pay me in advance or publish hardcovers anymore. So it just seemed like I couldn't write anything that was important enough. I wanted to do something. I knew I didn't have a ton of money to contribute anyplace, but I knew I had a really strong community of writers and readers. So I posted on Facebook and I said, is anyone else interested in contributing a poem or an essay to an anthology to help booksellers? Because booksellers have helped us all so much over the years, independent booksellers. And the response I got was incredible. And then I called my publisher of my first novel and I was like, what would you think of publishing an anthology to benefit BINC? And I really didn't expect her to say yes. But she was like, yeah, sure. And I'll donate my time and I'll ask IPG, the distributor, if they'll donate, you know, their share of the profits. And it all came together within about really a month. I didn't actually know what I was doing, but when I started getting essays in, and I got a lot of essays first, I think before poetry, it became clear what I needed. You know, I really felt like I was putting something together. I wasn't sure what it was. So every piece I got in really informed everything else. And with the murder of George Floyd, it became really more about not just pandemic, but about all this other stuff we were going through. And I remember Flames piece was the last one I curated. And it was the piece that for me just brought everything into focus in a way. I think it's the shortest piece in the book, but it's also just the strongest about so many, I can't even explain, but just, I think it's just every piece brought something to the book.
What were the parameters that you gave the writers, or did you leave it really open-ended?
I think it was pretty open-ended. I don't remember. I mean, does one of you remember what the parameters were that attracted you to say, hey, yeah, I'd like to do this? Because everyone contributed their work for free, which I really wasn't, right. I wasn't expecting people to want to do that. And, you know, I think I was just, what's your experience during the pandemic?
I only ask that question because sometimes I find it's almost helpful to have parameters around something so that you, you know, if you have a word count or if you have, I mean, certainly the theme was there from the beginning, but sometimes that makes it because they were all on a very tight deadline. Right? I mean, you started this, I don't know when you put this call out, but from that to publication on September 1st had to be incredibly tight deadlines that they were operating under. So
yeah, I posted on Facebook on April 15th, I think it was.
Wow.
And by May 15th, I had almost all the pieces. And yeah, and so then I needed to get it to my publisher by June 15th. So it gave me 2 months. And it's interesting because if I had gone through a traditional, you know, one of the top five publishers, one of the big five, I would have had to have my agent pitch an idea. I would have had everyone at the publishing house would have had to all have their input on who was going to be in it, on was I the right person to do it, which, you know, I've never done an anthology before. I had no idea what I was doing. And the process would have taken at least a year. And this all came together in really two months. So I think that just shows the power of independent publishing. Of my publisher is a small independent publisher. These booksellers that we're supporting are also a lot of them are small stores or small business people. And I think it's more important than ever that we support each other in this community.
Absolutely. Well, we can talk about this in the course of it, but it's also really interesting how life was shifting. You're right in the middle of writing about something. I mean, I know with your experiences in Rwanda, when you wrote 10,000 Hills, you know, that was a process that you had already digested. It was an experience you'd already lived through and you had time to think about it. But writing in the midst of something, and, you know, all four of you can speak to this. I think it's very interesting to process something in real time, as opposed to having time to sort of think about it and digest it. You've really got to react on the spot. So, well, maybe we can do that. Robin, maybe we can start with you and you can introduce your piece, talk about your decision to say yes to Jennifer. And once you were on board, how you kind of processed it and decided what you were going to write about.
Well, I saw all the buzz on Facebook. Jen and I are Facebook friends. And I actually reached out to her and said, oh, I don't know if you need anybody else, but I'd really love to be part of this. It seemed like the whole thing was such a brilliant idea and could be such an important document of the time, you know, in a way that I don't think any single individual could write a whole book about it now. But just hearing all these voices and getting this kind of snapshot of the moment seemed like something I really wanted to be a part of. And what I remember is I think there was either 1,000-word or a 1,200-word limit, which I did find helpful. Because, you know, as you say, sometimes when you have to do something quickly, having a set boundary can be very helpful. And my piece, it's called Needle Cast, which is the name of a tree disease that killed some trees here on my house, around my house. And I think for me, you know, it was early May. I think the only way for me to approach this in a sense was through metaphor. And the piece I ended up writing was really about my own inability to comprehend the hugeness of what was happening. And as Jen knows, an hour before I sent it to her, I drafted an email to her saying, I'm so sorry, I've failed in this task. I can't possibly do this. I envy the people who are capable of writing things quickly. I just can't. And I didn't send the email. And I sat down and then I finished it and sent it off to her. And I've thought a lot about, like, why did I have what I think of as like that failure moment? And I think it was because for a moment there, I thought I had to be smart about this. And I can't be. I still can't be. I don't know if I ever will be able to be. And what I had to let myself be was just kind of impressionistic about it, as opposed to coming up with some intelligent summary, because I just don't think any of us are there yet. At least I'm definitely not. But yeah. I've read through a lot of the book, including the contributions of my two colleagues here, and it's pretty stunning.
It is really stunning. It's interesting because a lot of people, I think, have been reflecting on nature. This came up for me when reading your piece. Well, I mean, we have a lot of time to stare at trees right now, right? To just stare at our own windows and to watch not only the reports coming back every night on TV, but to watch things dying in your own front yard of this disease. I don't know if that idea came to you very quickly. It sounds like you had a crisis of confidence right before you wrote it, but what a perfect metaphor, and to see it reflected in nature, as so many people have been reflecting on nature and nature suffering its own like comeback in some ways in the pandemic. You know, a lot of the earth seems to be healing itself, but in this case, not so. And the title was so beautiful. I thought it was really, really stunning. Did it go through a lot of, so you sent it, you had your crisis of confidence an hour before you sent it out, but you obviously must have written it by then. Did it go through a lot of revision?
I'd written most of it, but what I had was I had the essay, which is kind of a collage essay. It is, as I said, it's kind of impressionistic, and I had most of it. And I think what the crisis of confidence was really, which I think as a writer, since we're talking to writers here, you know, I think is something that I've certainly had with a lot of work I've done, and I've seen other people have also, which is not that you haven't written enough, but that you kind of haven't like turned the kaleidoscope the right way so that it's all shifted in place. And so what ended up happening between me thinking this will never be finished and me thinking, okay, I can send this. And, you know, like all writers, I sort of rebel against the word finished, but you know, I can send it off. And what happened in the middle there wasn't so much like the generation of more material. It was some rearrangement, and it was me kind of understanding the piece better rather than me changing it a lot. It was me kind of understanding what it was I was doing. You know, in longer time frames, we always say to people, you know, put it away in your drawer for a year or a month or 10 years or whatever, you know. And this was sort of like, go make a cup of coffee, come back, see it differently. This has to be in. So that was what happened.
I think that's one reason the pieces were so extraordinary, a lot of them, because no one had time to really futz with them. I mean, Roberto, I remember you were like sort of procrastinating turning it in. And then I think you did yours pretty short in a short amount of time. And it was like so immediate. And I think that happened with a lot of people where it's like, there's really no time to put it away in the drawer. And it's like, what am I feeling now? And the results, I think, were really, like I said, extraordinary.
Roberto, can you talk about your piece? I loved how both Robin and Roberto addressed lavender in their piece. You know, this... we're all going to the calming things that we can find, and lavender is certainly one of them. But anyway, can you talk about the genesis of your piece?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me, and thank you to Jennifer for including me in this wonderful collection that I haven't finished everything, but from what I've read, I'm in awe that we did it in such short order and with such eloquence and beauty and power. When Jennifer invited me to join it, we were in the middle of an economic It was clearly economic. We're in a downward slide of the economy, global pandemic, and climate change was waiting for us just behind the curtain of those two. So what writer doesn't have free time to give their labor away for free, right, under these conditions? I say this in jest because it's just as a way to say powerful idea will draw from us things we might not even be capable of doing, like producing an essay in such short order that I hope reflects at least some aesthetic values that are sublime or beautiful. So I think, you know, the powerful idea that Jennifer had in bringing us together for a good cause kind of just naturally stirred, I think, the writer's subconscious to produce what the writer's subconscious is capable of doing under the right condition. And I actually, so in terms of my essay, my book, it comes from having spent some time in this space. It comes from the fact that born in San Francisco, but my family's from a little country called El Salvador, one of the most consistently violent places on earth since its foundation in 1821. So as a journalist, I've reported on state terror, gang violence. I've gone to some of the scariest places in the Western Hemisphere. People try to kill me on different occasions and see natural disasters in countries where there's major genocide, and have a, actually on a personal level, have a connection to both one of the most violent episodes of the 20th century, 1932 in El Salvador, through my father and other family members. And I myself was a witness and not just a witness, but a participant in a war as a part of the a guerrilla army in the late 80s and early 90s. So, you know, we're talking about a global crisis right now. Well, I've kind of been looking at my former place where I had a watch and say like, okay, wow, people are starting to catch up to the apocalyptic sensibilities the Salvadorans have, mm-hmm. as one of the most consistently violent places on earth, right? And so I hate to say it, I feel like we were wired in a way for writing in under conditions of pandemic and crisis, because we have never in my lifetime had a moment of whatever that fiction called stability is. And so you know, I thought, wow, what an opportunity when Jennifer invited me to share some of the best practices of how to deal with colossal crisis, you know? And so one of my secret weapons actually has been lavender. Lavender that is helping my father chill out from his dementia, lavender that has been with me after death squads try to kill me, lavender that's with me when I meet a new love and I want to share something meaningful with her. That was the genesis. It wrote itself because of the powerful idea that Jennifer organized this around.
I have to say, I really marveled at your ability to go from your father's dementia to El Salvador to finding this hopeful new love in your life in a super compressed period of time, to cover all those incredibly weighty subjects that each on their own could command an entire novel or, you know, memoir, and connect them through the connective tissue of the lavender. And so it just felt very organic. As you say, it really felt like it wrote itself, but it tackled a whole breadth of the spectrum of human emotion. And it was really, really incredible. I don't know if it sounds like that was an organic process for you, that those things naturally connected in your own mind. And so they naturally connected in the essay. But I don't know if that took a lot of massaging in the revision process.
I took some massaging, but not too much, right? I mean, Jennifer, it is what we do as writers, right? We have our obsessions and we're sitting on them and they're growing within us like lavender. And eventually there's an opportunity for them to come out into the light, to sprout above the ground and do their work of smell, of sight, of taste, and all the things that we as poets and writers do. Been dealing with civilizational crisis pretty much my entire adult life. And I've had lavender with me my entire adult life through that. So it was easy. Honestly, it was easy because it was already there, sparked by the powerful idea.
It's funny because right before the radio station closed down for the pandemic, one of the last books we did was on El Salvador, a U.S. journalist's take on El Salvador. So I had just sort of read up on a lot of that. And it is, so the essay was even more meaningful to me with that background. But Flame, I don't know if there's a way to do this, but I would love, if there is a way for you to do it, to read your poem. It's a little complicated, I know, to read it if you can choose to or not to, but it's visually very interesting on the page, and I don't know if there's a way to translate that in audio. But if it is possible, it would sort of set the stage to do it, but you can decline if you so wish.
I would definitely have to pull it up, but I do not mind. I'm doing a lot of contrapuntal poems these days anyway. So I'm working on how do you read a contrapuntal poem effectively, but I'm happy to pull it up if you give me just a moment.
You'll have to define that for us, because I think of our writers are so in, you know, well-versed in poetry, so to speak. So I'd love for you to define your terms.
Sure. A contrapuntal poem is simply a poem that is written in columns, in which you can read down the columns or you can read across the columns and get very different meanings, very different experiences from each reading. Sometimes it's done in a very almost like a litany, where the words are repeated and repeated and they become almost a mishmash in your mind. It's a lot of fun to play with. It has this call, this very natural call and response element to it, which I love from my music days. So I've been exploring how do you, and it has to make sense. Like, how do you read across and have it make sense as well as, you know, down the column? What to bring to a die-in? Leave security blanket, inescapable skin, tongue, justification. Bring bulletproof vest, reliable witnesses, white, choking throat, guns. Leave, bring, security blanket, bulletproof vest, inescapable skin, reliable witnesses, white, tongue, choking throat, justification, guns. And if not your guns, then your wide screaming mouths. And if not your screaming mouths, then your gasping tears. And if not your tears, then your fist clenched in anger. And if not your fist, then your hands raised in surrender. Bring your own body, pulsing. Add the heat of your children, the ones still left living. Lay down. Be empty. Silent. Become the ideal image of you. Don't. Brace for impact. Expect them to shoot.
Was this written in the aftermath of George Floyd?
No, it was actually written. I don't write responsive poems very well to these things. It was written when Jennifer approached me. It was at the very last moments of putting the anthology together. And she asked if there was something that was resonant that I had written or would be willing to write that was resonant. And I think as has been expressed, I was having a very hard time writing anything. Most of the poems that I have that feel urgent are actually things that I've had to sit with for a long time. I can write about ghosts and hauntings and personal experience, and I can journal for days, but to write in response to what's happening in the world is, there's first a lot of trauma and processing for me to get through before it becomes a poem. And I often find myself questioning whether I have the right or the authority. I have no intention to be the voice of a people in that way. I don't feel that that's my calling as a writer. More of a witness. And this is definitely a witnessing poem. A lot of it comes around the fear for my own child whenever something like this happens, and it always happens. It's the summer of blood in general for African Americans in this country. Every summer swells with bodies. And so this was actually in response to a die-in that happened after Mike Brown was shot. And it was the first time where there were a lot of white people joining, and how much safer the protesters were, how much safer the people who were laying down were, because they were surrounded. They had people who were white with them, essentially. And we saw that really take off this summer, where more and more white bodies were putting themselves at the front line, putting themselves in between the cops and the protesters. And so it was a call to action that felt urgent again. I picked some ghost poems as well to submit to Jennifer, and she selected this one, and it felt like an honor, honestly, because it is a poem that is its own haunting. It comes back around, and it's always relevant, and that's really awful. This anthology has been painful in a lot of ways. While finding community, while feeling a part of something, we are still very much alone together, and it's awful in that way. And you now risk actually dying to go and protest. You risk it in more ways than one.
What I appreciated so many things about this poem, but the resonance of the die-in, the two layers of the die-in, right? The die-in for the protests and what's happening on our streets versus what's happening in our hospital beds are two simultaneous, very real die-ins. And when you read your lists contemporaneously with both of those things in mind, it's very interesting, right? And so it felt like you were speaking to a lot of issues all at once, which is the goal of poetry. But it's amazing that a poem written prior to all of this can speak to all of this on so many different levels at the same time. I thought that was really remarkable. So you're a performer and a composer, and I was wondering how much of those things you bring to your poetry as well. You alluded to that at the very beginning, that you were thinking about music and your composition as you were assembling this poem. And I was wondering if you could talk to that, what your other skills in life bring to your poetry.
I studied music. I studied vocal jazz performance. So I'm originally a jazz and blues singer. And when I started writing music for myself, I started with blues. I'm very fond of wordplay. My mother was a philosopher of language. And so I grew up with logic problems and double entendres and a lot of word jokes in my family. So I love clever lyrics for that reason. I love the sort of the play on words and the way of being raunchy without being raunchy and saucy without being saucy kind of thing. When it comes to poetry, I approached it first as a performance poet. So it was very much how it sounds coming out of your mouth, not how it looks on the page. And so years ago, I did slam poetry, competitive poetry, that kind of thing. And I would always incorporate some kind of musical element to it, either some sung lines or I would do an excerpt from a song that just fit the poem. And from there, as I said, I started exploring this sort of how do you represent that kind of call and response on the page? How do you make it so that the reader, if they never hear your voice, are hearing two voices or are hearing a dialogue? On a page. And it's funny because then you do readings and you then have to figure out how to interpret two voices back into the air after you put them on the page that way. I would say that the biggest thing is I want accessibility. I want people to feel like they understand what I'm saying and they relate to it because they at least can sympathize if they can't empathize, that they see themselves there or they see people that they care about on the page. And I think that songwriting and poetry poetry can get very abstract and very, you know, removed from this is what I'm talking about. And my approach to songwriting, the simplisticness of the blues that does have those double meanings and all those layers to it, I try to bring that to my poetry too, where there's more. If you read, there's more, but it's not for you to not understand. It's for you to be welcomed in too. In the same way that songs, you should enjoy the song. You should want to sing along or bop your head or dance a little bit. Otherwise, why am I making this song? Is it just for me? I don't make poetry just for me. So I'm hoping that you nod along and go, yes, I hear you, or I can see that, I understand. And that's, I would say, the biggest crossover influence is how to be accessible.
Isn't that funny how people are so unintimidated by music? Nobody feels intimidated by music and so intimidated by poetry, right? They're like, I'm not smart enough for that, but I can dance to this.
And right. Yeah, I think that's right. And it's so similar. So many of my high school English teacher friends, I have quite a few actually, they hate the poetry unit. They hate teaching poetry for their kids because they're just like, I don't understand. I'm just teaching them rules that don't really make sense to me. And I don't know how to write this. And so to have them say, oh no, I understand this poem. I get it. I see what you're doing. That kind of welcoming in, it's like, it shouldn't be scary to think of reading a book of poems. It shouldn't be like, oh, well, why would I do that? Oh, because you could see yourself there. That's why. Right. You should want to pick it up and see yourself there. How right. do we cross that bridge? I don't know. But I think this is a start. Putting it in among, you know, I love essays. I love short works. I admire short works. It's hard. It's hard to write a good essay, a good solid essay. All those complicated, like you were talking about with Roberto, like, how are you going to pull all these complicated things? Now, how do you do that in a poem too and still make it makes sense? That's aspirational.
You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guests today are Jennifer Haupt, the editor of Alone Together, and contributing writers Amber Flame, Roberto Lovato, and Robin Black.
I'm really glad you mentioned this issue of authority earlier on. You were talking about, do I have the authority to write this story? Do I have, you know, I'm a witness. I'm not a participant or so. You phrased it much better than I, but I was going to open that question up to the whole group because I think a lot of writers struggle with that. That do I have the authority to speak on this topic. And it's a big topic. You know, when you're charging writers with writing about the pandemic, of course, they're writing about their experience. But I was wondering if any of you struggled with that, struggled with feeling like you had the authority to speak on a subject so large and how you kind of overcame that.
Yeah, I can speak to that. Like as I mentioned, I'm born in the U.S. I'm a citizen from San Francisco. I'm not some tropical dude as the publishing industry will make me, right? Because one of the only ways that Latino or Latinx writers can come into the publishing system is to be what I call tropicalized. So you'll notice people's pictures, they have rubber trees, they have colors, schemes that are very tropical, or you have to go in through the gangway or through the immigration way. But you have no right as a Latino person to speak to the national narrative of the United States. Just look at your bookshelves or Sunday talk shows or any major national conversation doesn't include us, even though we're 60 million strong and many of us descended of peoples that were here before the borders were. So the challenge, that's one challenge. On the other hand, my family's from El Salvador and I spent time there and I participated in the war. But there are people that have far more experience over there engaged in these matters than I did in my time that I spent there. And as a Salvadoran, your subconscious has these like piles of bodies, right? Because the scale of the gang violence, for example, surpassed the killing during the war. And El Salvador, when I was there for my book, Unforgetting, became the most violent country on earth at that moment in August 2015. So your subconscious has these piles. So if you have these piles, you look at those piles of bodies and you say, damn, am I really the one to write this? Well, I mean, it was either that. I've helped other writers tell their stories in other presses, but my book's the first book in the English language written by a Central American in the United States. It's nonfiction. It's about us. We've been here for a long time before the wars in Central America, but you wouldn't know it from the bookshelves. So right. I had to make a choice, and I made the choice to say, yeah, I have to tell this story. I have the means to do it, and I'm going to put el todo por el todo. I'm going to give everything for everything to do this. I'm going to put all the love and passion and power that I have to bring to this because I don't want my people to be erased, just like most of us don't even know the names of anybody that was killed in El Paso, right? Massacre that happened a year ago, which is the anniversary today, right? So that's the unique condition you face as a Salvador, as a Latinx writer or as a Salvadoran writer. There's also, you know, sub-identities that come to play. So I had to navigate these different terrains, and I hate to be a broken record, but if you have the right idea, the powerful idea, it's going to drive your heart, and it's going to make you, like my mom, unflappable before anything, right? To realize her mission with her family, there was nothing that could stop my mother. I mean, that's why my boundaries are sometimes weak. Mom was just a force of nature. So, but with that same power, if we bring it to the writing, will help us overcome the different voices, the chatter that will tell us you're not worthy, you're not good enough, your words don't matter, you're not qualified to say that. You've only experienced that much war. There's people that experience that much war. All these different voices that are not very useful to the writing process and certainly not to the growing human being process.
With putting together the anthology, Roberta talks about having the idea and that being the seed or whatever. But what I had to learn was how to draw a diverse, you know, and I'm starting to hate that word diverse because it's like so overused, but a diverse roster of authors to the project. Because what I realized fairly quickly, and honestly, a little to my shock, and I think, and I'm embarrassed to admit this, but I think it's good to admit it because it's just putting it out there. Most of my writer tribe was white, you know, white middle-aged women. Imagine that. And so my real challenge was, okay, I have this idea, but it has to reflect really America, what's going on. It can't just reflect my tribe. And so I think the real gift for me in this process was expanding my, you know, what I call my tribe, my network of writers. And so I think that was the hardest thing for me. And the thing I'm proudest about is really creating, and I think an American experience of what this is and not just a white experience. But it's interesting when you talk about writing with authority, because when I first tried to approach, honestly, when I first started to try to approach authors of color and no one would respond to me. And I asked a friend of mine, I said, why is this happening? And she said, because writers of color don't feel like they have
the authority to speak as much as white people do. And so I hadn't really, it was just interesting. I hadn't really thought about that. And I wanted to ask Roberto and Flame about that, if that, you know, what their perspective is on that in terms of being part of this sort of experience and the concept of having authority. And
you said something earlier too that I want to, you said that you didn't want this to be just your experience. And I think something that Roberto's also talking about is that this is one of the experiences that is happening right now. There was a summer of killing that just happened for Black Americans. And Roberto's talking about war and like the ravages and what, you know, this sort of generational legacy. And they're not inseparable. We're not just right. There's no way to just write about the pandemic for brown people. It's tied into everything. I don't think it's so much thinking of the authority as there's an exhaustion. There's definitely an exhaustion. People want to suddenly hear from Black poets, Black writers, Black musicians, Black artists when their shame and guilt mount, when it spills over into the streets, when it's obviously wrong. You know, there's this whole kind of joke on Black Twitter that's going around, like how many of your news feeds return back to normal because white people, especially white women, got tired. Because it's exhausting to fight racism in this country. It's exhausting, not even to fight it, just to live in this country. And you don't have to. And so if you can set that aside, it is a very, very easy step to go ahead and set that aside. And to say, okay, you know, I'm dealing with the pandemic. It's scary. Everybody, you know, I know people who are sick. I know people who are dying. That's true. And there's always an and, I think. And that's, it doesn't surprise me that if you didn't have those connections, that they're not easy now to make. Because there's an exhaustion. Am I being asked more? Am I being asked to, you know, read for Black Lives Matter movements? And, you know, it's like Black History Month comes along and that's when all the gigs are, right? And the rest of the year, they're not thinking about you. They're not asking for you to show up. When it's our time, that kind of feeling, but we're tired too. Like we're tired and there's a lot of other things going on as well. And I really encourage, and I'm happy that you committed to that. It makes me happy when I see white people who are committing to like, I'm going to do different and I'm going to commit to this work because it's work. It's hard. It's not over. And it's not going to be over when COVID is over. It's not going to be over when we're not going to have a vaccine for racism. So we're not going to have a vaccine for the poverty-stricken colonial impact on entire countries, generations of people. That's not something that's going to go away. And so prioritizing this, I think it helped when you shifted, when you came and asked me, which we were connected through a person of color that we had in common. I didn't know you before. You didn't know me before, Jen, but it was awesome because you came to me with this sort of open hand of like, I want more people of color in this. They need to be voices in here. It's important to me. It's important to the work. It's important to the world that this is not just one perspective, that this is not a narrow lane. And you could have, and it would have been successful and people would have still wanted to read it. And you know, all of those things could have still happened for you without you having put in the work. And so you did, you put in the work instead. And I appreciate that. And I will acknowledge that. But also at any point you could decide that you're tired, you know, you don't want to anymore. And we don't have the option of not wanting to anymore. And I think that's really important in terms of when it's hard to write and it's hard to know what to look at and what to write about and what to try to address with your writing and whether it's even important. What is art? Why is art important? People are dying right now. You know, people are sick and losing their jobs and homes and the food supply is being cut down. And let's talk about the migrant workers and the migrant camps that are just being flooded with COVID. There's so many things to think about and to process and to hold, and that they're heavy and they're not particularly creative spaces to be in. But I think what kept me or got me back to writing, because I paused for a long time. I felt very stuck and it wasn't long for a lot of people. They're like, you paused for a month. That wasn't much. And I'm like, when you write all the time, a month pause feels like I'm never going to write again. I don't know if I'll ever have anything to say. So in my pause, what brought me back was an article about how during the Spanish flu pandemic, there's medical research and all of that kind of writing, but there wasn't anything about daily life, I don't know if any of you read this article, but there were very few accounts of how the pandemic actually affected daily life. There were very few photos at the time. There was no social media, obviously. So capturing what it was like to live through the pandemic was mainly caught through women writing each other letters. And so these really pretty rare documentations of daily life were in personal letters back and forth between mainly women. And so the encouragement of the article was to write during this time, to journal during this time, to write down what it's like to live through a pandemic. I'm making sure to write down my daughter's experience because she's having a completely different experience than I am because she doesn't have to worry as much. She just has to suffer the effects, which is loneliness and no socialization and restrictions on how and where she can go places and who she can talk to. But it's not fear-based so much for her as just like, wow, this sucks. For us, we're like, and there's a reason it sucks because it's scary. So just trying to make sure that I faithfully commit to not disappearing. My voice won't disappear. There will be writing of my experience and my friend's experience and my partner's experience that will be documented, and maybe nobody will read it and nobody will care, but you can't say I wasn't here. And I think something about that was like, I'm here. I'm still here. And if I'm still here, then I might have something important to say, even if it's just that I got through the COVID pandemic. That's enough, I think. And it was allowing myself to be enough in that way, to say, this isn't a brand new poem. I'm not writing something that's just like, wow, what an amazing, like, but I have written some amazing stuff, and I will maybe again. And maybe I'll look back one day, you know, after it's sat in the drawer for a year, I'll look back on the things I'm writing now and be like, oh, there was something there. How about that? But it's too muddy right now. It's too muddy to really just be like, I'm going to be a creative and I'm going to write a poem about the pandemic and how it's affecting us. That was too focused for me. So instead saying there's place for your words here and they're valuable. Let's keep them. Let's make sure that they live on and that this experience is captured in multiple voices and not just the one that I know and am familiar with. That was your commitment to the work. And it wouldn't have happened if you had given up and been like, well, they're not answering, so I guess it'll just be middle-aged white women in this book. It could have been simple.
I think it's a form of, mm-hmm. you know, of active resistance because we're being so suppressed in so many ways, all of us. And I mean, particularly mm-hmm. people of color, obviously, but to just keep writing, even if it's not, you know, earth shattering or you think, my challenge is to keep writing and not be like, oh, this sucks, but I'm going to keep writing, to keep mm-hmm. writing and be proud that I'm actually writing.
I think that's so interesting what Flame said about letters, because without knowing that, I've found myself writing more and more substantive emails to women, specifically to friends, just writing them every 2 weeks. And instead of just, okay, see you at 4 or whatever the text is, you know, here's what's going on in the household. Here's how this child's doing. Here's how I'm doing. Here's what we're doing. In a way that I think we all did when email first came out. And it was like this second great epistolary age because everybody was suddenly writing these long letters to each other. And then we kind of backed off from that. But I've definitely felt like that's what I can write now. And as a fiction writer, where I've really struggled is with the invention of any other reality. So right. I'm good documenting my day. I'm interested in essay. I think in a million years, I never would have written an essay about the pandemic if I hadn't known there were 75 other people speaking at the same time, just to address that sort of authority issue. Like that takes the authority off in some way, because you know, you're not saying, let me define the pandemic for you. But when it comes to, you know, this degree of destruction and death and everything that's happened in the last 6 months, and obviously, you know, I say this from a position of privilege as a middle-aged white lady, and I'm aware that there's been destruction and death before this, but we're in a pandemic. I find the idea of sitting down and writing, you know, some imaginary person's issues with their everyday life that I'm inventing and they're having difficulty in their marriage or whatever, just not to demean that work. That has been my work and I don't look down on it. but the pull of real life is really taking me away from fictional invention, I would say.
Mm-hmm. I look at fiction as it's almost like my therapy, really, honestly, Robin. I feel like, because actually Dani Shapiro had said something about using fiction as her time when she can escape from the pandemic. And I thought, that's such a lovely idea. And so that's what I've been trying to do the last couple of weeks, is because I feel the same way, like my fiction is like, what's important about this? And I've started really looking at it like, this is for me. And it's my luxury where I can just escape into novel land.
That's interesting.
There's no Trump, there's no any of this crap.
I haven't gotten there, but I'm inspired. I'm listening.
I see nonfiction like that, writing nonfiction. Like, I really discovering this, I was a journalist and then I became a creative nonfiction writer, whatever that means. I'm still trying to define it. You can read my book to see what I mean by it. But learning to narrate in different ways and using the techniques of fiction writers has really helped me to kind of foreground and color and bring music to the different parts of things that would have been more monotonous journalism. I'm sorry to all my journalist comrades, but that's how I feel now is after writing my book. So I'll give you a story. I was going to be a minister. I went to Bible school and I loved the Bible ever since I was a kid. Jesus was my superhero. And I got into a bit of a troubled life and had to get out and became a born again Christian right wing. I got on my knees to pray for the election of a guy named Ronald Wilson Reagan. That's how friggin' right wing I was as a born again kid, you know, because I was at risk, quote unquote, and I had to find a way out. So, you know, I ended up going to Bible school and then quitting the entire enterprise and joining Salvadoran Revolution. So I'm a man of extremes, to say the least. So we're in extreme times, and I feel these are my times. I still read like theology, and I like it, you know, especially when it's well written. And it's, you know, because the idea of God, the idea of redemption, the idea of salvation, the idea of this enormous power beyond ourselves, still, you know, it has a lot to do with, I think, the narrative unconscious of the planet, right? And you can go back to ancient cultures with this. I read theology, and I found that this one theologian, Anathea Poitier Young, she had written about what we call the apocalyptic literature of, you know, the book of Daniel, the book of Maccabees, Judah, and in order to understand the conditions under which they were written, which was what we would call state terror, she went to two countries. One was Argentina during the Dirty War, and the other one was a little country called El Salvador. So at that moment, I realized, man, we know as Salvadorans more about apocalypse than as much about apocalypse as anybody. And so I really, as a person of color, and one of that's kind of in this Latinx, Latino box, whatever the hell that means, to go back to that question that Jennifer mentioned, how do you navigate like the space as a person of color and do you, I feel welcome? You know, we as Latinos are positioned as, you know, tropical sidekicks to the national narrative of the United States. That's the best thing I could say about it, because we're not in the dialogue. And I commend Jennifer for doing the work to reach out to people. At Flame mentioned that we didn't know each other, but you reached out and you talked to people that I trust, and you know, that kind of transferred my trust to you. I constantly find myself having to make sure that I emphasize, hey man, I grew up down the street from the projects in San Francisco. I'm not this tropical dude. And so we Latinos in the US have a story here. You know, and then within our groups, we have like the marginalization of Afro-Latinx voices, trans voices, indigenous voices. There's all these, this is just a measure of the work I think that we still have to do in literature, whether it's fiction and nonfiction, to be more broad and inclusive in the ways that Flame especially was talking about.
Well, the challenge is to do it in a way that is, you know, goes past Black History Month, but it's organic, right? I mean, that's the thing. It's like, you have to really broaden your networks, not just like ask people of color to write for an anthology, but so then I'm like, okay, so then how do I do that? How do I really broaden my network beyond like just the work realm of it, if that makes sense. So that I'm not just trying to be inclusive on a work level, but on more of a organic level in a place where, you know, I live in Bellevue, which is like kind of suburban across the bridge from Seattle.
And honestly, there aren't a lot of people of color here. I mean, and so it becomes like this issue of really having to think about, and the only word I can use is organic, how to organically expand who is in your life so that you are organically inclusive and not just inclusive during Black History Month or during putting together an anthology about the pandemic, you know, or whatever it is. So,
Amber. It comes up with AWP panels.
Yeah.
A lot. Like a lot of my friends who are people of color every year around April or whenever it is that those panels are, will say, okay, you know, suddenly I have 10 new best friends who want me on their panel.
I would also love to hear from all of you who've had time to spend time with the anthology, sort of the biggest surprises that came up for all of you. You know, if something came back to you that made you understand what we're going through in a different or surprising way, kind of what struck you from the collection as a whole?
I think the biggest thing for me would be the difference in place and how much that affected. So reading from people who are in different environments, it's a totally different world. I mean, I grew up in Arizona and I can't even imagine being in Arizona during this time. Like I can't imagine surviving there during this time for multiple reasons, mostly personal, but just where you get stuck. I think the relational quality, like who's around you, both in that sort of community, when you step out the door, are there people who are wearing masks and taking care, or are there people who are not? And that was, it was really, they're going through a whole different thing in the Midwest or the East Coast, even in the South, than they are here in the Pacific Northwest. That really struck me.
I was stricken by this, it really excites me. I see in the anthology a preview of, and I mean this, a future of U.S. literature. Because I think notions of literature in the United States prior to COVID-19 were, I think, fraught in many ways. Just for example, if you look, and limited and myopic even. And I don't mean to just cast everybody into this, but just bear with me. Like, I'm the kind of guy, I'll go and I'll look at, like I've gone to see children in cages and they try to hang themselves because they're suffering so much, or they slit their mother slit their wrists. And I'm the kind of guy, I'll go see that. And then I'll go see the literature prizes. And I'll notice not a single one of them, of the prize winners in literature, got even meant, whatever, criticized Obama publicly, because it was Obama that did that to those children. We're used to hearing that from Trump, when in fact it was Obama that started the cage. But the criticism of Obama is not something that you get prizes for. It's quite the opposite. You kind of almost have these filters. Mm-hmm. So I see in the collection a kind of a bear. We're smashing the barriers because we have to be more nakedly political for the survival of our children, for the survival of the planet. And I can see the urgency that I saw in El Salvador, growing in the. I see the urgency in the words and between the lines. That excites me because. And quite honestly, I've been waiting. Given all the shit I've seen, I've been waiting for a while. And I'm now like, all right, you kind of see what the United States is in this different way now. And we can cast aside the things of children and move on to the things of adults. So I'm excited. And again, I commend you for bringing us all together to do that.
I hope so. Yeah. It became more politicized as it went along, because I felt like our democracy was really being threatened more and more. And I feel almost really like it's not enough, but particularly, well, I don't even want to get into politics, but come September, you know, like I remember the first person I interviewed was Luis Uria, and I told him, I said, you know, I just want the takeaway from our interview to be, get the hell out and vote. Because it's like, I just felt like with this coming out in September, even though it's about the pandemic, I want that to be the takeaway.
A good call to action. Well, congratulations to you all. I mean, it's just a stunning collection. I think people will find in it, we've brought up a lot of heavy topics today, but people will also find in it a lot of sweet connections and a lot of romance. And it's the broad spectrum of the human condition, for the good, the bad, the ugly, and the traumatic. And it had all of that in it. And hats off to all of you. I mean, it really was wonderful. You've all contributed something really great to the writing prompts and whatnot. So I'm going to put that up on the podcast as well. And hopefully that'll get people jump-started on their own writing. But you all were wonderful. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much.
That's all the time we have for today. Barbara will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.